This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. And today, the beginning and end of history frames our hour today. What do you think of that? Are we fighting the battles set in motion in 1945 even today? Are we returning to some of them in this century? Let's start with the Obama pivot to Asia. Are you having a hard time seeing it? You're not alone, but we've got a gallery of art stories also this hour, from the power of artful food to bring peace to a war-torn city to what does a simple sketch tell us about the military tribunals at Guantanamo Bay and art at airports, not in your baggage, not getting a bust of marble through security. No, the growing importance of public art in the stressful era of flying. But we begin with some retro-sounding words from President Obama this week.
In the near term, America's diplomatic efforts will focus on two particular issues: Iran's pursuit of nuclear weapons and the Arab-Israeli conflict.
That's a speech that might have been given in 2003 or 1993 or even 1973 when the old Shah of Iran was openly considering a nuclear program. Could we imagine a moment when these old issues and conflicts were in the distant rearview mirror?
The United States is uniquely positioned to play a leading role in the Asia Pacific because of our history, our capabilities, and our credibility.
That's former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton in 2010, who toured Asia in her very first trip as Secretary of State. That was back in February of 2009. Today, Secretary of John Kerry is off to the Middle East. So where is the so-called Asian pivot policy today? With us is Bonnie Glaser, Senior Advisor for Asia at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Bonnie, welcome.
Hi, John.
So did you notice an absence of talk about Asian policy, about the embrace of Asia, the whole notion of the pivot to Asia in President Obama's speech this week at the United Nations?
Well, yes, I did. It was rather remarkable. The president mentioned China once in the just a broader context, along with many other countries. There was no mention of Japan, of India. So, yes, the president seems to be quite focused on the challenges that the United States faces in the Middle East. But having said that, the president himself will be heading to Asia in October. He will be spending an entire week. He's going to Brunei. He's going to Indonesia, the Philippines, and Malaysia, attending two really important meetings, APEC, the Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation Forum, and then the East Asia Summit. So it might be a little bit too early to declare the death knell of the pivot, but it certainly is getting a bit less attention this week.
Well, it's out of the headlines and out of the rhetoric, but from your perspective, what are the issues that the U.S. and the Obama administration is going to face in Asia, and what's the legacy for the next couple of administrations?
Well, the issues are certainly participating more in the economic dynamism in the region. That's a broader policy, of course. The Obama administration is seeking to conclude the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the TPP. They've said they'd like to wrap it up by the end of October. It may slip a couple of months, but hopefully that will get done. And I think that will be very, very significant and a very important legacy for the president. Another issue is providing reassurance to countries in the region who are a little bit worried about China. They want to have trade with China. They want to have good relations with China, but they feel a little vulnerable. They feel vulnerable to Chinese coercion, economic and potentially military. And so there's been this demand pull in the region. That's the word that our former national security advisor, Tom Donilon, liked to use, that the United States is seen as more important in the region, and these countries, including virtually every state in Southeast Asia, Northeast Asia, perhaps with the exception of China, really wants to see the United States present, involved very actively in the region, militarily, diplomatically, and economically.
Are we hamstrung, though, by our Taiwan policy and our inability to sort of end the conflict in Korea, to really make that changed from 1950, really, when the seeds were sown there, and ultimately that will be a conflict point?
Well, Taiwan remains an issue, but I think that the mainland and Taiwan are working out their differences right now fairly constructively and peacefully. That could change. Korea, we still have a whole set of problems. North Korea's provocations do continue, and I don't expect any progress there in the near term. But if North Korea begins to act up, we will certainly see U.S. attention once again pulled back toward the region. But let's hope that the United States can chew gum and walk at the same time. That is, that we can pay attention to the Middle East and also to Asia. But that will be challenging, especially if this crisis in Syria continues.
And certainly North Korea has used distractions in the Middle East as an excuse for provocations. And the question of whether the U.S. will be competing with China or cooperating with China is something we'll be dealing with all century long. Bonnie Glaser, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Bonnie Glaser is a senior advisor for Asia at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. This is The Takeaway. Congress has a deadline regarding the federal budget and trying to take down the Affordable Care Act, but so does the entire healthcare industry, getting ready for the big changes the act will bring on October 1st. Software designers are maybe under the most pressure, overdosing on caffeine and pizza to set up the various online health exchange portals, websites, and apps that will deliver what the Affordable Care Act promises. Manoush Zamarodi, host and managing editor of WNYC's New Tech City podcast, has been watching this healthcare revolution through a digital lens. Success for these new healthcare websites could change the way we all use technology.
For a lot of technologists, it represents a huge business opportunity. They're saying that there's going to be 30 million more patients who get insurance. And these technologists, these entrepreneurs, want a slice of the pie. Healthcare is the fifth largest sector of the economy. If you separated it off, it would be as big as the economy of France. So this is a huge business opportunity for entrepreneurs and techies.
And part of the signal comes from the Obama administration and the president himself, who really wants this to be easy. So what are tech firms doing to gear up for now? They've got a deadline. Tech firms love deadlines, right?
Yeah, oh yeah, they do like that. They like to bring it down to the wire. So that you're absolutely right that I think affordable care has been abstract. So their whole theory is that we're going to create these portals, right, that make it as easy as possible for you to get into what should be your healthcare marketplace. And the idea is that there'll be competition there. So you can go in there, you can shop around. And I think what they're also saying is that to make it that easy, though, requires a lot of information that has to be put in. So they are really working down to the wire to get it all done because things are supposed to start next week.
And when we say portal, I mean, we're talking about a website, a website that would deal with certain kind of services. I mean, they're actually analogs for what the tech firms are coming up with for the ACA that already exist in the market.
And that's right. And we talked to one guy, Sanjay Singh. He runs a company called HCentive, which is creating these exchanges for several states, including New York State. And here's how he puts it.
So you will come to the portal, you will provide your basic information, create an account, and after that you shop like you shop on Expedia. Now you can compare plans like you were not able to do before, and then whatever you like, you buy, and then you are off exchange after that.
So the illusions that you can create on a website in terms of ease of operation, ease of access to information, conceal the agonies of trying to actually put all of this together, and that's the challenge for these tech people.
That's totally true. I mean, it all looks so easy and simple until it's not, because let's keep in mind, we're still talking about insurance and we're still talking about Obamacare and legislation,
right,
which are all extremely complicated. So these CEOs are really saying to their engineers, we need you working 18 to 22 hours a day. They are providing all their meals when we went to visit them at these places.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And one CEO.
Lots of pizza boxes.
Yeah. Another CEO, Eugene. Yeah, exactly. Seon told us that he's doing all this for engineers, and he heads up a software company called Softheon. This is another one. They are based in Long Island, but interestingly enough, they're building Massachusetts healthcare exchange. And where the idea is for these portals to be easy to use, as we said, the details are complicated.
You can enroll anytime after October 1, but your policy will be effective as of January 1st. We expect people going to be enrolled into the multiple health plans as part of the process and wait till the 31st, and they're going to say, oh, I'm not going to pay this one. Imagine that you make three flight reservations in advance. The day of the flight, you say you pick the one that you want to fly with.
These websites, they have to verify your identity or your eligibility for programs like Medicaid, but they're getting the data from state governments and hospitals, and this these records are still in the dark ages. They've got old computer mainframes. A lot of the doctors and hospitals are still using faxes if you request your records. Plus, there's always human errors. So, for example, if you type a wrong number or you forget to type in some information on one of these exchanges, you won't get the right estimate of how much your new health insurance costs. It's not like booking a flight from New York to Vegas. You know, they don't really need to know that much about me. Am I a senior citizen? That's it, pretty much, right?
So, really, that's the design challenge. You have to create a front end for the consumer that's going to question them to make sure the information is all really, really correct, absolutely correct, coming from the consumer. But on the back end side, the provider wants all kinds of different information to set their prices for insurance. And that means going to the Veterans Administration, going to, you know, some dark closet somewhere where there's a lot of faxes.
Totally. They are the portal, right? And for you to pass through the portal, all things have to line up. So, yes, they need to connect to those places that you just mentioned. But right now, the engineers are also, for the next week, pretending to be us, typing in wrong stuff, pretending to be confused, so that it's not a total mess on day one and bad PR for Obamacare right off the bat.
And how about the doctors? Do they have to have an easy way to use this?
Well, that's the idea. The idea is that this is going to lend transparency. So in theory, you should be able to go on there and see all of your health records from all the different people you see. Wouldn't that be refreshing? And you would actually be able to see why things cost as much as they do instead of this sort of cloak and dagger that goes on when you need to see a healthcare provider. So a lot of these companies are saying the doctors are going to have to be more transparent as well.
All right. You'll be watching long after October 1st. Manoush Zomorodi, thanks so much.
Great to be here, John.
Manoush Zomorodi is the host of WNYC's New Tech City. And next week, before the official launch of the Affordable Care Act, we're taking questions you might have about its rollout and implementation. What confuses you about the new system? What do you need to know more about to cover you or your family members? Send us your questions. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or post them to our Facebook page at facebook.com/thetakeaway. Coming up, art near the runway and at 30,000 feet.
Oh, stewardess, I speak jive.
I know you've got a long list of things you hate about airports these days, but what do you like about LGA, DFW, SFO, or PDX?
Hi, this is Kim from Portland, Oregon. My favorite airport is the Portland Airport because it's got free Wi-Fi, it's super compact, you can get around there really quickly, they have great microbrews and local wines and awesome food, and kind of an enjoyable place to hang out, so thumbs up on Portland.
Hi, this is Kimberly calling from San Antonio, Texas. I made a trip through Madrid, Spain a couple of years ago. The airport is beautiful, great architecture, great coffee, and really friendly people. You should try it sometime.
Kimberly and Kim, two great suggestions of airports, and they're absolutely right. I've actually been to Portland and Madrid once. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Be a part of the conversation. What's your favorite airport moment, airport installation, architecture, public art at an airport? Find us at facebook.com/thetakeaway. Later this hour, we're going to talk with a courtroom sketch artist from Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. And if the idea of art at Gitmo seems counterintuitive, perhaps the closest thing to that clash of experiences might be the idea of art at an airport.
An alarm has been activated.
Flying, the 21st century hazing of humanity. Off with your shoes, turn off your phones, laptops, dump your liquids, people. But the lucky people at O'Hare's huge underground tunnel that connects concourses B and C have been calmed down, dazzled, and distracted from their aviation abuse by the Michael Hayden neon art installation, The Sky's the Limit. You can hear the musical accompaniment to the light show that's been greeting passengers on the other side of security since 1987. More recently, you might be left holding your carry-on bag while impromptu tango dancers whirl by in Charlotte's airport. Airports are now the scenes of art happenings, as well as little museums, memorials to Charles Lindbergh in Minneapolis, and the Seattle-Tacoma airport. You'll find works by Frank Stella, Robert Mackey, and Robert Rauschenberg. In San Jose's airport, you can walk beneath a cloud made up of hundreds of panels, and each panel depicts the changes in weather in all the cities you can fly to from San Jose. Dan Goods, Nick Haffermoss, and Aaron Koblin are the artists behind the E-Cloud.
Come fly with me, let's fly away.
You know, maybe all this public airport art is making good on that glamorous Sinatra promise of flying long ago. These days, among the most important curators of public art in America do airports. We've got two with us today. Rebecca Bloom Rothman is the public art project manager with the Phoenix Officer of Arts and Culture in the midst of a multi-million-dollar public arts project in the Phoenix Sky Harbor Airport. Rebecca, welcome.
Hello, John.
And Colleen McPolland is the manager of the Aviation Art Program at the Seattle-Tacoma International Airport. Colleen, welcome.
Hi, John.
So how do you submit requests for proposals? How do you design where it is art's going to go? How do you keep artists from scaring people going onto airplanes? What are the kinds of things that make a airport curator different from a museum curator? Rebecca?
Well, in our case, we put out a call for artists, and we ask artists to join the design team so that they're integrated into the role of design of the space, right there with the architect and everybody else who's building on to the Phoenix Sky Harbor Airport. And they have to go through a pretty rigorous selection process similar to the architectural team, where we get a request for qualifications. We get resumes and past samples from all over the country.
And some of it's big, some of it's small. Colleen McPolland, what's your ideal notion of a quality public art experience as someone is making their way from the drop-off of bags through security and off to their destination?
That's a great question. There's so much that goes into that. I think that it's a piece of work that transcends both the place and the language. So even if you're from another country and don't speak the language, you can connect with the art. It is also work that doesn't interfere with the operations of the airport. We have 33 million passengers a year, so we can't impede that flow. It is also something that the people can connect with. For example, very simply, we have a piece that is bronze fish meandering down a concourse. Kids get that right away, and you'll see them walking with their parents, and pretty soon the kids are kind of following this path, and the parents are saying, come on, let's go. And then they get it too. They see what the kids are looking at, and it's kind of like an aha experience that they enjoy together.
Anything that can reduce the stress. So Rebecca
Bloom,
Rebecca Bloom Rothman is public art project manager with the Phoenix Office of Art and Culture, and we've just been speaking with Colleen McPolland, manager of the Aviation Art Program at the Seattle-Tacoma International Airport. So Rebecca, airports are opportunities for performance spaces, concerts. It goes way beyond sculpture, right?
Yeah, absolutely. It can. I mean, airports are cities within a city. Here in Phoenix, we have 40 million people come through the airport per year. So there's a lot of space, there's a lot of activity, and art's part of the human experience. Art makes the airport a destination in and of itself. All kinds of opportunities, really.
How much of an uphill battle is it, though, to reassure people who are in such a state of stress? And we'll get an answer from both of you. Rebecca, you've got a huge airport you're dealing with. Colleen, they're all a bunch of sort of flyboys there in the Boeing world, boys and girls in the Seattle-Tacoma. Colleen, how much of an uphill battle is this? And then we'll get a comment from you, Rebecca.
I think that since 9/11, people have more dwell time once they get through security. So they're ready to kind of relax once they get through and experience the airport, which is what we found.
That's a great point. Colleen McPolland is manager of the Aviation Art Program at the Seattle-Tacoma International Airport. Final thought, Rebecca, quickly.
Our work is actually done before security in the public spaces. And we tend to think about the airport as a place for grand arrivals and departures. So we're thinking about how the artwork can transform your experience of travel the minute you enter that airport.
Hmm. So getting people ready to deal with security, that's a great idea as well. Rebecca Bloom Rothman is the Public Art Project Manager with the Phoenix Office of Arts and Culture. It's in the midst of a multi-million-dollar public arts project in the Phoenix Sky Harbor Airport. And Colleen McPoland is the manager of the Aviation Art Program at the Seattle-Tacoma International Airport. Thanks to you both.
Thanks, John.
Thanks, John.
What is your favorite airport and why? The design, the food, the art. From Savannah, Georgia, we got this. The Barcelona Airport, big, beautiful, clean, and wide open spaces. Much easier to accept flight delays when you are somewhere you don't mind hanging out. Boy, that's the truth. One of you in Florida, the San Diego Airport. It's not too busy, clean, modern, and rocking chairs everywhere. In Colorado, one of you says the airport in Auckland, New Zealand, because it has the most adorable penguin footprints on the way to the terminal. Flies to Antarctica. Let's go there tomorrow.
My name is Sam Campbell. I'm calling from Indian Land, South Carolina. The best airport art I've ever seen is in Charlotte. It's a statue of Queen Charlotte.
What do you like about your favorite airport? Have your say at 877-8-MY-TAKE and follow us on Twitter at The Takeaway, all one word, at The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. The National Endowment for the Arts today releases its comprehensive survey of trends in participation, attendance, and investment in art in America. It's a massive job for Sunil Iyengar, research director at the NEA, and not just because of the scale of the U.S. population. With all the options Americans now have to consume entertainment, media, small screen, large screen, even since the last report in 2008, I asked Sunil a very basic question. In 2013, what is art?
What is art? Consuming art. Consuming is one of the many activities that Americans all around the country partake of in engaging with art. Art itself could range from a variety of different forms of music, dance, or theater. It definitely encompasses design, architecture. It also takes in media arts, which is, in a sense, its own phenomenon. When we say media arts, it's a very expansive term. We also find, of course, that when we say art, we're talking about some of the types of folk and traditional arts that have been done throughout the centuries. Finally, I think I would just say that don't forget literature. That's definitely an art as well.
And are these various options competing? Is there a net increase on some level? Are certain categories doing better than others? What do you see in the big picture?
So in the big picture, there's certain categories that generally produce the largest number of participants. So if you were to look at how many people saw an art exhibit or went to the a museum or a gallery, or how many people participated in and went to see an arts or crafts fair or outdoor performing arts festival, some of those kinds of activities for some reason generate higher numbers than if we asked, did you go see a classical music performance or did you see a theater performance? We find that movies, for example, is really at the top of the list there. About 59% of all Americans went to see a movie in the last year, and that's compared to about 54% the last time we did the survey four years ago. And that's one of the few areas, by the way, throughout these attendance activities where we see a marked increase. For the most part, attendance seems to be holding steady, and in a couple of areas, we saw some declines as well.
How do you gauge people who consume media via, you know, checking out vines for hours or sorting through YouTube videos, some of which are artistic, mm-hmm. others of which are just purely voyeuristic? Right.
We do ask by electronic media, and we ask about a variety of forms, for example, inclusive of TV and radio, but also, of course, the internet and handheld mobile devices. And we ask about the type of art they consume with those devices or technologies. And what we find is that about 71% of all adults consumed art through media by those definitions in the last year. And that, again, if you take that number, 71%, it's overwhelmingly larger than any of the other individual arts attendance forms, which is only natural, right? If you think about the population scattered in various regions, some remote from arts cultural facilities, some right in the hub of a metropolis where there is a lot of sort of arts attendance opportunities, you find that people in remote areas are engaging with the art through media.
Finally, what would you tell art institutions about how they might use this data. Of course, they'll make their own decisions, but should museums be more like movies or digital art because those are the most popular, those are the bigger numbers, or do people express a real sense of whatever art they're consuming, they want it to be in the category that it's in and not try to jazz it up with digital fads of one kind or another?
There's obviously never going to be a uniform way of answering that question for everyone, but what I would tell arts institutions to do with these data and these findings, beyond getting people to interrogate the findings and find out what it means for them, is to take back to their institutions a question about the degree to which the growing trend of participation in its fullest sense, and if they can find ways to target specific art forms, I think they'll find ways to grow audiences.
Sunil Iyengar is Research Director at the National Endowment for the Arts. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
If you want to find out more about the NEA's new study, be sure to listen to the live stream or attend State of the Arts, sponsored by our sister station WQXR. It's taking place next Thursday in New York. You can find out more at thetakeaway.org. What if the show Top Chef was set in a war zone and the contest was to use your restaurant to deliver peace? It's no reality show, just reality for restaurateur Ahmed Jama in Mogadishu. The skilled Somali chef left London 5 years ago to open restaurants and cafes in his hometown. He battles Al-Shabaab on a daily basis, the brutal terrorists who massacred the people at the Westgate Nairobi Mall this week. Zan Rice is the West Africa correspondent for the Financial Times, who profiles Jama in this week's issue of The New Yorker, a story about one man's food fight to reclaim his home.
I think the food is an element and is an important element, and he's certainly a very proud chef. I'll just say the food is actually very, very good. But I think, there's a wider social goal that he's trying to achieve. He's trying to get people to come together, to sit down, to be able to relax, to talk, to have a little bit of normality in their lives that, people outside Somalia or everywhere can relate to, just going for a meal at a restaurant. And for many, many years in Mogadishu, that just wasn't possible.
And is that exactly what made him a target of Al-Shabaab?
Yeah, I mean, I think initially he wasn't the target. What he had done with his restaurant is he had provided a place where that attracted a certain clientele, including government workers who were obviously an enemy of the Shabaab. They were trying to stop any sort of functioning government establishing control in Mogadishu, and his first restaurant was very close to where the government sat. Businessmen too would come there, and journalists. And I think one of Shabaab's aims is just to prevent the idea of normality in Mogadishu. So by Ahmed doing what he did and opening this restaurant, that became a sort of symbol, and if they attacked it, they would be able to kill or injure people who they regarded as enemies. So I think initially that was the case.
What sacrifice has he made to maintain this sense of normality in a place that is anything but?
Yeah, I think he's made some enormous sacrifices. I mean, personally, he's been away from his family for 5 years now. He's got a wife. He's got three kids. And originally, he would have liked to have brought them to come and live in Mogadishu, but it's just not stable enough to, and he knows that. So he's missing his kids grow up in London, and he's very aware of that, and he feels some guilt about that.
And also the casualties in the restaurant incidents that he's had to endure, suicide bombers, attacks.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's what I was going to say. I mean, he's lost a number of staff. I think six staff he's lost. In total, of the people that have been killed at his restaurants, I think it's more than 30. So customers he would have known. And these are, these are suicide attacks. They are extremely brutal, traumatic things to deal with. He was present at one of them. I've got the scene in the piece where he's actually inside the gate of his restaurant and the suicide bombers don't get in and blow themselves up outside. And he actually goes up and clears up and puts on a pair of gloves and picks up the heads of these attackers and goes and throws them in a dumpster at the end of the road. It's almost hard to comprehend what he's seen and the level of personal trauma, sadness, and probably guilt he's felt as well, because these people have died in his restaurant. So, yeah, I think the sacrifice has been huge.
And it gives new meaning to the whole notion of restaurant work. He's holding back the forces of politics, forces of brutality and violence, as well as just the regular cleanup that you have to do after a lunch rush hour.
Exactly. I mean, he's dealing with stuff that no chef anywhere else has to deal with, just the daily security issues and worries that he has to attend to. I mean, it's extraordinary.
Zan Rice, West Africa correspondent for the Financial Times. His profile of the Mogadishu restaurant owner Ahmed Jama is in this week's issue of The New Yorker magazine. Thanks, Zan.
Pleasure. Thank you.
We leave you here with a bit of the voice of Ahmed Jama, taking time from his kitchen to speak with CNN.
I just wanted to show the world, everyone, to show them we need help.
This is The Takeaway. Perry Como made Till the End of Time a number one song can be thought of as the beginning of our time, 1945. Hard year to get a handle on.
What is it?
It's about you. Something about your robe.
The forces of Germany have surrendered to the United Nations.
Till the end of time.
The first atomic bomb was dropped on Hiroshima.
The battleship Missouri becomes the scene of an unforgettable ceremony marking the complete and formal surrender of Japan.
Rope, I don't understand.
Oh, forgive me. Something struck me.
Till the end of time.
Glimmers of 1945. Hitchcock's movie Spellbound, the bombing of Hiroshima, end of World War II, Perry Como singing there. But in 1945, the United Nations Charter was also signed, the World Bank was formed, the Arab League began, Gandhi and Nehru demanded that all British troops depart India, the independence movement that would create Israel began to gain momentum, the seeds were sown for what became the revolutions in China, Vietnam, and Korea. Talk about the Asian pivot, as we were earlier this hour. There is no pivot away from the history that began in 1945. We're living it today, in surprising, nuanced ways, as well as in the obvious ways. Ian Baruma's new book is called Year Zero, A History of 1945. Ian, welcome.
Thank you.
And for you, the idea that 1945 is the year zero is a very personal one in terms of your own family, as well as a rumination on how history and narratives of history can start in a single year.
Yes, I mean, I was born in late 1951, and my generation, our generation, really grew up in the shadow of World War II very much. And in primary school, we heard stories from our teachers of derring do and resistance, mostly entirely phony. So it was a pivotal event, even though we didn't experience it. And my own father told me a lot of stories, and unlike some sons who find stories of their parents wartime period a bore, I was always very interested in it. And so that's really how it started.
And the themes that you evoke here in this book, Year Zero, run the gamut from really the invention of world government, which is what 1945 is about, the sexual revolution, which in many ways is what 1945 is about, and the invention of globalism on some level. Let's take the sexual revolution first. What do you find in the sort of moral upheavals of 1945 that set the stage for everything that came after?
Well, as women in Saigon and Vietnam can also testify, women of a certain generation, the presence of huge numbers of young men from another country, especially if they have more money and they look smart and slick and so on, are going to have a big impact. And a lot of young women are going to find their ways into their arms, paid or not. And the period just after the war in 1945, in many places with liberating troops and so on, was a bit like a huge orgy. And women got out of hand in male eyes. And so there was a sort of moral panic, too, about all these dancings and girls giving themselves away for chocolate and chewing gum and so on and so forth. And so it had a huge impact, and it was very quickly reined in. And I think the conservatism that followed in the late 40s, 50s, in some ways was a sort of reaction to what had happened.
So the backlash really pushed back on the sort of sense of morality out of control, but it also created the seeds for a kind of cultural exchange, a sense of experience something beyond one's narrow kind of view in the silos of Iowa or even France that really began to germinate.
Well, that's true. I mean, we began this section with Perry Como. In some ways, Glenn Miller would have been more appropriate. The liberation of Europe, large parts of Asia, the occupation of Japan and Germany was very much set to the tune of Glenn Miller and jazz, and the world was ready for it. And so America, really, for at least one or two generations, became the place of freedom, of sexual freedom, of jazz, of music, and so on, later of rock and roll, of course.
America's global influence really began in 1945. And the characters who embodied that are people like Douglas MacArthur, who had a role in Japan that we can barely imagine today in terms of the way the Japanese even treated him.
Well, here in America, of course, he's chiefly known for being a wild and autocratic military figure who threatened to use the atom bomb on the Chinese in the Korean War. Japan, he has a very different image because people are so terrified of what might happen, and they were so frightened that the American occupation troops would do to the Japanese what the Japanese had done to the Chinese and other Asians. That the relatively benign U.S. occupation of Japan was an enormous relief. And MacArthur acted as a kind of partly as a kind of Japanese shogun, partly as a father. It was an image very deliberately manipulated. He very rarely showed himself in public. He had almost had the mystique of an emperor. And people were grateful that he'd brought a lot, or he himself didn't, but his administration brought things like democracy, women could vote. Life became gradually better, even though the first years were, of course, incredibly hard.
That kind of influence by an American figure, inconceivable today, yes.
Yes, and he saw it himself in rather messianic terms. I mean, if he'd had his way, all Japanese would have converted to Christianity, which was not on. But he did see it as a kind of religious mission to re-educate the Japanese into becoming American-style Democrats and so on, which they didn't, of course, but nonetheless.
Did humanity overreach in 1945? And in a sense, what we've been living since is a feeling that never again.
Yes. On the other hand, I mean, out of periods of tremendous destruction, you get periods of creation. And the idealism that was also part of 1945, as well as the hunger, the horror and so on, the revenge, the idealism was part of that too. People wanted to build a better world in which these sort of things couldn't happen again, a world that was more equal, more united. One source in my research, very valuable research was an U.S. Army magazine called Yank, written by American soldiers for American soldiers. Well, the politics of Yank were to the left of the Democratic Party today.
And this United Nations General Assembly week really created in the seeds of 1945. Ian Buruma, author of Year Zero, extraordinary book, A History of 1945. Ian, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Lumosity. Lumosity.com's daily workouts are designed to improve memory and attention, dedicated to helping people feel sharper, think faster, and remember more. It's all at Lumosity.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International, in collaboration with the New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
One more thought on the power of art this hour. Mugshots and aerial photos of men in orange jumpsuits, frustrated accounts of defense lawyers stymied by mysterious military tribunal rules, tense, terse public statements of prosecutors, reporters with limited access. Those are our paltry streams of information about the system of justice at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. But there is another source of information, and it comes from an artist. Since 2006, the Associated Press has sent sketch artist Janet Hamlin to Gitmo to document the proceedings of the military tribunals. It's the only visual documentation of all of the Guantanamo Bay tribunals, and a book of her work called Sketching Guantanamo comes out next month. Janet, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
What a crazy assignment. How did you react when you were told?
With some trepidation.
Yeah.
Understandably. But my father was military, so when we landed there, it was somewhat familiar, oddly enough.
And a fascinating glimpse into something that almost everyone who follows the news is curious about, right?
That's right.
And when you go to a typical trial where sketch artists are in demand, what is your mission and how is it different at Gitmo, do you think?
Well, generally in the mainland or in a typical court, we are sitting, the sketch artists sit towards the front or in the jury box, fairly close proximity to the detainee or the accused. Whereas in Guantanamo, since the second courtroom was built specifically for high-value detainee trials, we are separated by soundproof glass in the back of the room from, you know, a fair distance from the view. So I sit back with all the media and other members who are observing.
Do you use opera glasses and tell them to adjust the lights when it's too dim in there?
I wish.
Really?
There was actually a 3-year period where I could bring some magnifying glasses, but actually just this last June, they told me I could no longer use those.
Why do you think they tolerate this? And what do you feel are your limits? I mean, a lot of the reporters that we talk to on this program, we talk about what they can do, say, not bring to Gitmo, have very clear understanding about that, or if they learn, you know, right, when they're down there. What is your sense of the limits of what you can do as a sketch artist?
I will hasten to add that I do have access where I draw the faces from monitors. You know, that's how I can get facial views, but
sure,
that's from a separate room. And the limits are audio is a 40-second delay. So I'm constantly having to look up to see what I'm sketching, and I'm not hearing what's going on for 40 seconds. So, you know, there's that. There's also the fact that I have to have all my sketches signed off before they go out to media or to the world. By a security officer who is the same person that sits to the right of the judge in the courtroom and white noises any kind of, you know, testimony or whatever's going on in court.
The censor.
Yes, yes.
Do you have, do you have any kind of connection with this person? I mean, a relationship? I mean, not in a relationship sense, but just is he likely to say, oh, that's a good one, or look what you did with the green here?
Yeah, he actually does
really?
Do that. He gives me some artistic feedback. But in general, you know, we have an understanding that he needs to hurry over as soon as there's a break to review and sign off on the work so that it can then be moved out to media. But occasionally there'll be a delay, and I've had to hold up and wait for him because nothing can move without that.
What about the defendants? Do they have a sense of your work and how you're doing with their faces?
Well, they do. There was the infamous incident in 2008 where Khalid Sheikh Mohammed looked at the sketch I had done of his face, disliked it, and they held it on premises until I was able to go back, get some reference, and actually fix the nose on that. And there was another time with another detainee where he didn't want the sketches to go out at all, and I had to sit in court and make phone calls because I didn't want to leave. And it took 4 hours, but we were able to then move the drawings.
What are you capturing? I mean, because I look at a lot of your sketches, and it seems like, you know, obviously you're documenting something, you're doing something very straightforward, but you're catching a character. It seems like you're trying to grab a moment, maybe even steal a moment with your artistic eye.
That's correct.
Really?
And that's what I'm constantly trying to see, if there's some kind of body language or gesture or something that's going to bring that story home, what's happening in the courtroom. And I'm trying to do it in a way that's not necessarily putting my opinions out there, but just really capturing visually for the rest of the world, because it is a fair responsibility to be the only visual source. So I'm trying to approach it as a journalist might.
Give me a sense of the characters. Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, happy character, powerful character, angry character, some of the others.
You know, all of those would actually apply to him. He comes in and he seems to have a certain amount of control. The other four accused that are in the courtroom with him, they're all five being tried at the same time. They constantly look to him for direction. As time marches on, visually, he's gotten more and more, he's gotten the right to wear this camo jacket. He's dyeing his beard a more and more vibrant.
Which makes your job more interesting.
Yes. It gives me something very visually, you know, to grab and draw. They're bringing their prayer rugs in. I mean, he's constantly combing his beard and gesturing to his defense, and they're huddling in between, you know, during breaks and whatnot. He's a very involved and a very vocal person.
Do you think any of the defendants, or maybe this is actually even happened, have any of the defendants asked for one of the originals?
They have not, although the defense has told me that they like to look and see what's going on, and they've asked for prints of the work that they then show the detainees.
Well, I have so many questions to ask you. We have to go, but how long will you do this?
Well, I hope to follow it through until the 9/11 trial happens, hopefully. I mean, that's my goal.
Well, if you want to spend some time at Gitmo, you can take a look at Janet Hamlin's new book, Sketching Guantanamo, which comes out next month. Janet Hamlin is a sketch artist, the sketch artist at the Guantanamo tribunals. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you.
We talked earlier this hour about what makes a good airport experience with artists in mind. Based on your responses, Portland and Austin airports are topping the list for best. What's your favorite?
Hi, this is Cody calling from Linden, New Jersey. My favorite airport is Glacier Park International Airport in Kalispell, Montana. It's a beautiful, small little airport, always quick and easy to get through. People are always friendly. And whenever I fly there, I get to fly home.
This is Jane Byrie from Morris Plains, New Jersey. I love flying into Denver above the bright white tent-like structures that mimic the Rocky Mountains. The artistic wonders continue inside, including panoramic photographs, sculptures, mosaics, and more.
Denver is beautiful. Raleigh-Durham Airport, says Jennifer Atkins. Not too big, not too small. Proud Texan. Austin, Texas is pretty great. All vendors from local restaurants and a music venue, maybe more than one. Tell us your favorite airport and why. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
NYC Now delivers the most up-to-date local news from WNYC and Gothamist every morning, midday, and evening. With three updates a day, listeners get breaking news, top headlines, and in-depth coverage from across New York City. By sponsoring programming like NYC Now, you'll reach our community of dedicated listeners with premium messaging and an uncluttered audio experience. Visit sponsorship.wnyc.org to get in touch and find out more.